Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie. On this evening's The Space Show, writer Christopher Wonjick expands on some of the ideas in his book, Spacefarers, about how humans could realistically populate the solar system. Well, we're talking about the moon, why don't we go with the Ames brothers? Now, this is a fanciful invitation by a lover to go off to the moon on a supersonic honeymoon. Destination Moon.
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one. Come and take a trip in my rocket ship. We'll have a lovely afternoon. Kiss the world goodbye and away we fly. Destination Moon. Travel fast as light till we're lost from sight. The Earth is like a toy balloon. What a thrill you get riding on a jet. Destination Moon. We'll go up, 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 up. Straight to the moon we two. High in the starry blue, I'll be out of this world with you. So away we steal in a spacemobile, a supersonic honeymoon. Leave your cares below, pull the switch, let's go. Destination Moon. Into the Milky Way, we'll wander while we watch the folks down yonder. Oh, we're gonna have a lovely afternoon. Up on the highest constellation, we'll look out across the nation, cause the Earth is like a tiny toy balloon. We'll go up, 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 straight to the moon we two. High in the starry blue, I'll be out of this world with you. So away we steal in a spacemobile, a supersonic honeymoon. Leave your cares below, pull the switch, let's go. Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one. Destination Moon.
Well, the Ames brothers may have a fanciful idea of taking a honeymoon on the moon. With a little more down-to-earth view of the future of mankind in space is Christopher Wonjick. He's an American writer, used to work for NASA, and he's written a book called Spacefarers. And in 347 easy-to-read pages, he explains how humans will settle the moon, Mars, and beyond. Well, here is Space Association President Peter Iwood to introduce this evening's guest.
Christopher Wonjick. Christopher he received a bachelor's degree in journalism from Temple University and a master's degree from Harvard School of Public Health. He's an author of several books, Bad Medicine, Misconceptions and Misuses Revealed, From Distance Healing to Vitamin O, and Food at Work, Workplace Solutions for Malnutrition, Obesity and Chronic Obesity and Chronic Diseases. And these books, particularly about the second one I mentioned there, has got very high reviews, and it's a well-respected piece of writing. And it basically has kicked off some projects inspired by government legislation, Mexico, Lithuania, Uruguay, and South America. As an astronomy writer, Chris worked at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland until 2007, and he freelanced. He's currently the armchair astrophysics columnist for the Astronomical Society of the Pacific's Mercury magazine. As a health writer, he wrote stories for CBS Health Watch, The Washington Post, a weekly column in Live Science called Bad Medicine. And while a student at Temple University, he was part of a comedy scene and produced different comics, and he also had a stint writing for Jay Leno from 1998. Chris's book he's here to speak with us tonight is called Spacefarers, How Humans Will Settle the Moon, Mars and Beyond. It's available through, or it's published through Harvard University Press. It's got really good reviews, including from yours truly. I read it and I loved it. It was fantastic. So this review from Skeptic magazine, the best book on space exploration since Isaac Asimov. So that was Michael Schremer. And he's joining us now live from the US, if he's still there.
And in discussion then with members of the Space Association of Australia, Krista Wonjek had these comments about human voyages to the planet Mars.
But Mars is different, isn't it? Mars is a place where we feel we actually could live there in large numbers and raise children there. It has every element we need, and it has, you know, an environment that's very much like Earth. So it's very tempting. In fact, I think it would be easier to live there than get there. Right? That's the main problem right now. It's getting there because it's a 6 to 9 month trip. And, you know, you have the radiation issue that you're just bathing in radiation all the way there. You got the solar radiation, which you can protect against because it's not that energetic to some degree. But then the cosmic radiation is really the menacing stuff. The best estimate for these astronauts going there for a 2-year round trip is like 100 rems, which is a whole lifetime of radiation. They have to be protected in some way. In fact, the Apollo astronauts, they all reported seeing sparks, seeing flashes in their eyes at a rate of like one every couple minutes. What these flashes were cosmic rays, cosmic radiation going through their eyeball and literally creating sparks, you know? And if that's going through your eyes, like, you know, once every couple minutes, imagine what it's doing in your body. You're getting bombarded each and every second with these cosmic rays. It's radiation. These are atomic particles from deep space, from across the galaxy, from star explosions. And they go into your body and they tear apart your DNA. They tear apart all types of molecules. They break it apart, causing mutations. There's going to be a great need for massive protection. And one way to do this that's come on recently about the past 10 or 15 years is this boron nitride nanotubes. It was very promising. They're lightweight. You can see it's kind of fluffy, and it can be like insulation for the spacecraft, insulation for the space suit for extra protection that you can wear. And you can even make these into macro structures as well and have it, they're lightweight yet sturdy. And you can support the spacecraft with these tubes, and you could fill it up with hydrogen or water for even more protection. So very promising. I think we got the radiation situation in hand. The other problem is the gravity issue, which is also easy to solve. Well, NASA doesn't want to do it for some reason. NASA wants to send astronauts to Mars in zero gravity, which I just think, I mean, it's tantamount to murder. I mean, why are you doing this? This is what an astronaut looks like when she's on the ISS for 9 months. You know, she has to be carried out of the spacecraft. Who's going to carry her out on Mars? You know, that's what happens with zero gravity, regardless of your exercise regime, which is what NASA is relying on. That's insane. I know it's going to add money to a mission, but what you need is like an artificial gravity situation. And one of the most inexpensive ways I can do it, aside from these ornate spacecraft that you would have to build in space, is a spacecraft you would build on Earth, but in orbit, it separates. Maybe you have a cargo side and a people side, but it's connected by a tether. It could be up to like a kilometer long. And then you fire the engines, and then you send one side over the other. So you essentially go to Mars, rotating like that, all the way over, one turning over the other, all the way to Mars. And you could create your own sense of gravity in that regard. You could set it at Earth's 1G, or you could set it at Mars's, slowly get it down to a 0.38, to what Mars would be like to acclimate the astronauts on the way. It's very straightforward to do. Oh, right, we don't know how to land on Mars. So that's a big problem we have to overcome. The heaviest thing we have ever landed was about a ton. And now we're talking about landing humans with 20 or 30 tons. Dicey proposition. Elon Musk wants to send these things that are 100 tons. Good luck with that. lots of ways to get to Mars. I think this is incredibly cool. But, you know, the Elon Musk idea is just to send, you know, thousands of ships, each carrying 100 people, to populate Mars. If we want to really get a lot of people to Mars, that's what I'm talking about now, not just the first people. But what you can do instead is have these ships that never land on Earth, never land on Mars. They're essentially shuttles that are going back and forth in this orbit around the sun, this interesting orbit that takes it closer to Earth and closer to Mars, closer to Earth, closer to Mars, over and over again. It's a free trajectory. Once you get that in orbit, you don't need any more energy to keep it going. So when your shuttle, you could have maybe 10 of them all lined up. When they get close to Earth at the right time, you hop on it from Earth, you jump up there, you can load up hundreds of people, and then it takes about 5 months to get to Mars. And then everyone hops off. The shuttle, this is important, goes back empty, because at this point, the planets have kind of separated and they're on opposite sides of the sun. So it's going to take about 2 years for this thing to get back. But once it gets back, a whole bunch of more people hop up again and take that 5 months to Mars and hop off. You could have several of these things going at the same time, as I said, and that's how you could get the masses to Mars in these ships that never land. They could be very big ships because they never have to take off from Earth or land on Mars. You don't have to worry about that weight issue. Forward. Okay, so here's, we're on Mars and here's the problem. It's beautiful, right? And that's a problem because it looks tameable. You know, it looks like the outback or, but you know, the devil's in the details here, isn't it? There's all these serious problems we just kind of gloss over that we really have to address. One is the pressure suit. You know, the pressure is only it's only 6 millibars on Earth at sea level. We're at 1,000. So at 6 millibars, that's essentially like the moon's 0 millibars. You know, in all these future scenarios, everyone's in these kind of reasonable pressure suits. You know, they don't look bad. Looks like this guy's out for a hike. Doesn't look like so bad he could do that. This is one designed by MIT. It's been in development for about 10 or 15 years. Still doesn't work. Looks great, yeah. But you'd die if you'd be wearing that on Mars. You'll be in one of these bulky moon suits unless we come up with some new solution. And that takes a lot of the fun of being on Mars. It's not so easy when you're, you know, bouncing around on one of these. You know, we have this idea that we're exploring out there just like it's Earth, but it's not that way. And then there's the dust problem. You know, there's these dust storms. So whose job is it to clean these beautiful domes? All these domes always look very pristine, but it's going to be dusty as all hell. I mean, one of the rovers died because it got covered with too much dust. And, you know, it's one thing cleaning it, but the problem is some of these dust storms last a long time, right? A month, 3 months, a year. This is what we've only recorded in the recent history of Mars. So what happens to these trees in these domes after a couple months of no sunlight? They're all going to die. It's not as easy as it looks in these kind of pictures. And then again, the gravity issue. If 38% gravity is not enough to reproduce and raise children, then that game over for colonization, right? It'll just be kind of an adults only place on Mars, because if you can't raise children, then you can't really settle on Mars. And that's a big open-ended question. That's why I do think it's very important to go to the moon to at least learn on that chart. Remember, where does 0.16 gravity come in on that chart? It might give you a sense of what 0.38 is going to be. I'll wrap up here. There's a couple fun ways to live on Mars. A lot of them involve, you know, being underground or in some contained dark situation because of the radiation. This one's a little better. This is an inflatable habitat, which is kind of neat. And you would have to cover it with regolith to protect against the radiation, the soil there. But you need a lot of it, like 3 meters worth, to protect against the radiation. But this concept is kind of there's a membrane in here. You would fill it with Martian water or Martian ice. And ice and water, they're denser than the regolith. So you could have more protection for less volume. So that's kind of cool. You still wouldn't be able to see out of it. And that's a big issue. Why go to Mars and live in something that you can't even see the planet most of the time? So my idea is to like cut into the side of a hill, you know, like the northern slope in the northern hemisphere. So the sun is behind you. That means you're blocking out 100% of the solar radiation, and the planet itself is blocking out all the cosmic radiation from below, behind, and above. So you would only have a little bit of cosmic radiation coming through the front. And my suggestion is do this and have a massive window so you can be on Mars and actually see Mars and not be underground. How can you attract thousands of people to be living on Mars just to go underground? So I think that would be a cool way to go about this.
The author of the book Spacefarers, Christopher Wonjek. We have more about settlement of Mars coming up.
On FM, online, and on TuneIn, 24/7. This is 88.3 Southern FM.
The Mars Society and its Australian offshoot, Mars Society Australia, has long been an advocate of settling on Mars. To promote this, they have run several song contests. Here is one of the results written by Leslie Fish and Creasy. No pun intended, but sung by Sanders, here is Sands of Mars.
Oh, warrior of the sky, shifting sands of Mars. See the crimson light arise, grand and bright to mesmerize, children of the stars. You have called us through the years, shifting sands of Mars. So we'll cast away our fears, leave the earth as pioneers, children of the stars. We shall walk your ancient land, shifting sands of Mars, guided by an unseen hand, seeking yet to understand, children of the stars. See the sunrise over Thorsis, shining on the star terrain, casting light so strange and wondrous, rosy pink upon the plain. It's a sight we have imagined in our hearts and in our dreams, and we wonder at the beauty that few human eyes have seen. Towering cliffs and jagged spires, shifting sands of Mars, formed by your primeval fires, waken now our soul's desires, children of the stars. Gazing up at Terra's light, shifting sands of Mars, stark and wavering in your night, we find comfort at the sight, children of the stars. Here the universe we see, shifting sands of Mars, vast and glorious sets us free, threshold of eternity, children of the stars. Space that goes on endlessly, leads us to infinity, children of the stars.
In discussing how humans might settle Mars, Christopher Wonjek mentioned the need to protect the settlers from solar and cosmic radiation. In his discussion with the Space Association of Australia, he suggested one protective method.
Yes, but we do have a few questions. I'll chip through. There's a question here from Vienna. What chemical and physical properties of the boron tubes make it suitable for the radiation shielding that you mentioned earlier?
Okay, so it is fascinating how this works, because normally radiation protection requires a lot of weight, you know, like a lead apron when you go to the dentist's office to protect you from an X-ray there. But the boron, for reasons I don't know exactly, is it's a good absorber of secondary cosmic rays. So again, these cosmic rays, so when these cosmic rays, again, they're atomic particles. So they collide with the spacecraft, right? And then they create all these secondary particles. They're shrapnel, essentially. That's what makes cosmic rays particularly deadly. The solar radiation isn't doing that. They're not strong enough. They're like electrons and hydrogen nuclei, but these are like iron and such from deep in the galaxy. So they hit the spacecraft, create this shrapnel effect of all these other particles, which is exactly what's happening in our upper atmosphere when they collide with that. And the boron, for reasons of physics I don't understand, is a particularly good absorber of those secondary radiation. And when you combine that, if you can form it into a macro tube and then combine it with water, which you need to bring to Mars anyway, which is useful to you on the trip, or hydrogen gas, which is very lightweight, that actually increases the absorption of these secondary cosmic ray particles.
You may remember the movie The Martian, in which the protagonist grows potatoes in the Martian soil. It looked easy in the film, but what would be the reality? And how could oxygen be produced on Mars, which has an atmosphere of almost entirely carbon dioxide?
Air, there's lots of ways to breathe on Mars. There's no air, no oxygen to speak of, but we can convert it. And there's a mission, there's an instrument heading there now called MOXIE that's going to do a very simple experiment by converting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to carbon monoxide and oxygen gas. That'll be the major way to generate oxygen. But you can also do it with plants. And I visited this facility at the University of Arizona. This is a lightweight grow apparatus, and it's collapsible. These are all aluminum frames with some plastic. It's only about a couple hundred pounds. I mean, I was able to lift it a little bit. But what's fascinating is they can grow 1,000 kilocalories. They can harvest 1,000 kilocalories of food each day. And more important for this discussion, they could generate 100% of the oxygen needs for any adult. So imagine being on Mars and everyone gets one of these things. You know, you have all your oxygen and a good like half or a third of your calories. That's just a really neat idea. And again, lightweight and collapsible, you can send it in your spaceship. You would want redundancy, of course, in case the plants die and you're out of oxygen. But nonetheless, this is a good start. Because farming is going to be pretty hard. That's one other thing that's going to be difficult. I mean, Mark Watney in the movie The Martian, he was able to grow potatoes in the dirt. But if he ate them, he would have died because the dirt is toxic. The dirt contains perchlorates, and that would have caused some major thyroid issues for him. The writers, Andy Weir, did not realize how toxic the soil was. That kind of discovery came a little bit later. But there's also the light issue. There's enough natural sunlight on Mars to grow food, absolutely. At the equator, the intensity of the sun is a bit like Scandinavia on Earth. So that much is okay. But again, it's the dust storm problem. When dust storms come and cover your crops, would block out the sun for a month or so, you're in trouble. So you're going to have to rely on LEDs, which is okay, but you have to realize Mars will be forever dependent on Earth until they can make their own light bulbs. Because what happens when the light bulbs burn out? You're going to have to get more from Earth. But again, everything's going to be difficult on Mars. You have this idea, we just send normal people and they're all set to go. All we need is normal people there. That's what Elon Musk wants to do. But you know, I'm going to, for the first several decades, you're going to have to send some really clever people that really know how to build civilization out of thin air, more or less. But from now to that point, we need major advancements in technology, particularly AI, artificial intelligence for these rovers. You know, if you look at the rovers, they're just going inch by inch, right? Because they're not smart enough to negotiate the terrain, as basic as that terrain is. We need, you know, incredible advancements so that these robots can be moving around all them by themselves, exploring and building these shelters that we envision. All by themselves without needing to be monitored from Earth. Lots of technology needed to get to this point, and I'm wrapping up here, that, you know, this is really cool. I would love to be here, you know, like thousands of people on Mars. But what this represents really is trillions of dollars of Earth investment, okay? So how does that happen? This is unlike any colonization or settlements we've ever experienced before, because it's not old world, new world, and where the new world can trade fur and fish and timber and minerals and bring wealth back to the the motherland. There's nothing of value right now on Mars. So all these people, these thousands of people living on Mars, they're a bunch of moochers, aren't they? They're not making any money sending it back. They have to rely on the taxpayers of the world, of Earth, allowing them to live there for decades until maybe at best they can have their own self-contained economy, but still never be giving anything back to Earth. So what economic motivation is it for Earthlings to be sponsoring this? It's really something that has to be worked out until there's something we can get back from Mars that the public would buy into, I don't see how we can have thousands of people there. That's just my take.
The views of Christopher Wonjick, the author of the thought-provoking book Spacefarers. In his discussion with members of the Space Association of Australia, the topic of terraforming came up. Now, terraforming is a concept whereby a planet, such as Mars, could be altered to make it habitable for Earth, plants and animals, not to mention humans.
Terraforming, I would love to talk about that in depth. It's physically possible without magic. I think I say, you know, some things are just kind of engineering magic. Well, we can do this. But, you know, the premise is simple. I mean, if you heat the planet and there are non-magic ways to do that, you could liberate all the dry ice from below your feet, get it above your head to create some type of atmospheric pressure. And if we can raise that pressure from 6 millibar to about 150, then we could run around naked on Mars. Okay, how's that for a visual for you? You wouldn't need your pressurized suit if we can get up to 150. You have to be breathing 100% oxygen because your lungs wouldn't be able to function that low. On Earth, we're at 1,000. Mount Everest is around 500 millibar. But we could function without the suit. But the problem is that recent analysis has shown that there's maybe if you liberate every little drop of dry ice and put it up in the sky, you're only talking about 100 millibar. And that's a shame. I don't know where the extra pressure is going to come from. You know, one fantastic idea is you get an asteroid and you skim it across the atmosphere of Mars and release all the volatiles there. Again, you know, yes, you can do it. It's a bit like magic, but you can go for that. But that's the only way to fully terraform Mars. That said, at 100 millibar, you can still have plant life and things like that.
On the Space Show, we're listening to the views of Christopher Wonjick. We have more in a moment.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.
We're looking at the possibilities of humans living off Earth. You know, the Moon, Mars in particular, and later we'll look elsewhere. Well, here's a view that was put by Bernie Taupin and Elton John, but presented here by Angie Apiro.
Mars ain't the kind of place to raise your kids. In fact, it's cold as hell. And there's no one there.
The Earth has a magnetic field that deflects most of the solar wind particles away from the Earth. That means that the solar wind cannot strip away the Earth's atmosphere. Also, our gravity is strong enough to keep even the fastest moving air molecules from escaping. Mars, on the other hand, has no significant magnetic field. Solar wind particles are mainly fast-moving protons and electrons. These slam into the Martian atmosphere, energizing its molecules to escape velocity in the low Martian gravity. For some years now, the MAVEN spacecraft has been in orbit around Mars, measuring these escaping molecules and ions.
Fantastic. Another question from Ross. With regarding terraforming on Mars, how do we stop the gases that we introduce to Mars from escaping the low gravity of Mars?
Yes, it's my understanding that they can stay there for tens of thousands of years. So when we talk about gases escaping from Mars over the eons, this is happening over the course of millions of years, accelerated by the solar radiation pushing things away as well. But I'm told, I don't know how these calculations are made, that that process takes so long. So if we begin to terraform Mars, then we're good to go for about 10,000 years. And that might be enough pocket change to come up with grander ideas 10,000 years from now on how to self-contain some of that atmosphere.
In his book, Spacefarers, Christopher Wojcik spends chapters on how humans might live on planets other than Mars and the Moon. He summarized realistic ways this could happen in his discussion with the Space Association of Australia.
There's ways, again, to live on every planet if you can come up with a reason. I mean, you could be on Mercury because it actually fluctuates between hot and cold depending on how it's rotating around the sun. There's a night day and a night and a day. But you could travel at only 3.5 kilometers per hour. And if you can do that constantly moving, you can stay at dusk or dawn. You can stay on that terminator line between night and day where it's a comfortable temperature. And you can live on Mercury if you can come up with a reason. Again, you could live in the atmosphere of Venus at incredible luxury. This, you would have normal gravity, you would have normal pressure as far as we're concerned, and it would be 50 degrees Celsius, which is like a bad day on the outback, but you know, it's something we could manage. If you could have a reason to be out there, maybe to investigate life. You can ice fish on Europa in case there's some type of life discovered in that subsurface ocean. Or in Enceladus, which I think is actually a greater candidate for possibility of life, because they have geothermic vents, which on Earth serve as food for things that don't see any sunlight. That's really exciting. Titan, people talk about how living on Titan would be easier than living on the Moon because there's an atmosphere on Titan. I think they're daft. I mean, yes, you don't need your pressurized suit, but you know, what are you going to wear to protect yourself from the minus 180 degrees Celsius? You might as well be in a damn pressurized suit on Mars. Mind-blowing concept. You could tether Pluto to its moon, Charon, because they're tidally locked to each other. The moon is locked to us, but we're not locked to the moon. So the moon's kind of always showing the same face, but around the whole Earth. But these two always show the same face to each other. So you could attach it with a tether and it's only 19,000 kilometers. So we have, Kevlar can handle this. And then you could live in between there on these rotating habitats and then go down to the planet to visit or work. You know, it's always this crazy idea. In the future, we're going to be working as miners and farmers. We go back to the most primitive occupations in the future. But, you know, a lot of these scenarios, and this is fall apart because of this concept that Isaac Asimov introduced, terrestrial chauvinism. Why do we have this desire to live on the rock, you know, to live on these planets, on these moons, when you could be living above them in relative luxury? I mean, that's the probable thing that will happen. I mean, you could have rotating habitats like we want in low Earth orbit with artificial gravity and climate control. I mean, look at this one. It has patio furniture, for Christ's sake. Would you be here above Titan and then maybe go down to Titan to visit and explore because it's fascinating and then get back home to someplace that's reasonable to live? Why live on these rocks? It's just not practical. Again, why live on top of Mount Everest? Beautiful to see, but just not practical to live.
Space Association of Australia President Peter Aylward had this question for Christopher Wojcik.
One of the things I really like about the way you start the book off, actually, is essentially laying out kind of three reasons why we'd be doing or why exploration or space exploration has happened and the motivations behind them. And I'll sort of paraphrase you. One would be for military advantage. Another for praise or glory of a leader or a dictator, and the other one for economic reasons. And I think what you've said tonight and in the book, you know, we've got to try and work out which one of those is practical and reasonable and sustainable. And I think, like political situation in the US, it seems Trump is, or the powers that be, are painting China as being the military driver to do what we're going to do. Obviously,
tapping into a sense of patriotism, and China is making great advancements, you know, and they're human beings and they should be lauded for what they're doing. I mean, they've had two space stations already and they're building a third, And they're the ones that can get humans up into low Earth orbit. The United States didn't regain that capacity to just a few months ago. That said, yeah, we can, that is a good driver to start getting into space, but it doesn't last very long. That was the problem really with the space race. And people say that was a good thing because it got us into space. That's one way to look at it, but it was very narrow-minded. We just had to get someone on the moon, and we failed to create any type of infrastructure or any sense that we were going to stay there for a long term. And what would have happened without the space race, we don't know. But back in the 1950s, there was discussion about this international collaboration of starting to get into space with communication satellites and things like that. It was the Russians who threw down the gauntlet with their Sputnik, and the U.S. had to challenge that. And it went off in a different direction. But I think that we would have had this natural progression without the space race of first getting into low Earth orbit and then gradually building out to the moon, not going to the moon first and then backtracking and then, okay, now what are we going to do? That's where we're at now. So if we follow this impulse to just challenge China, I think we're going to do silly things. We're going to spend a lot of money on things that are just not practical for long-term habitation in space.
Well, that's right. And
trying an economic reason to stay.
Trying to find that economic reason. And I think you pointed to it, and I think you make reference to in the book, about on the moon, for example, you know, at some stage, if a business is able to generate liquid water or hydrogen oxygen from moon resources and sell it to the expeditioners or the miners or the explorers, that's going to be the way to move forward. Yeah.
Yes. United Launch Alliance has already put a price on it at $500 a kilogram. And they're going to need, I think, 1,000 metric tons. So I did the math earlier. That's like $1 billion worth of fuel that they're willing to buy on the moon. And NASA is going to need a fair share of that as well. That way you don't have to carry your fuel to the moon, which has been a major problem, even going to Mars. You carry all your fuel to get back. So the way you can just enough fuel to get you to the moon and then rely on the fuel there to go to the next step. That's a $1 billion business right there.
At the time of our conversation with author Christopher Wonjek, the United States was heading into a presidential election.
Chris, do you have a sense of what the direction going forward with either of the two candidates in the upcoming election might be? Do you?
Yeah.
Would you like to share those? Or?
Yeah, no, I will. So the current president, Trump, he says a lot of things. What he wants is a mystery, but he tries to appeal to his base. And this idea is very patriotic, that we're going to go back to the moon and we're going to go to Mars. And he wants to create his legacy in that regard and then create this space force, which is kind of needed, but maybe not yet. That is what I was saying earlier. That's a fine idea if you do it appropriately, but I think he's going to be pushing for this to be done inappropriately, not in a way that's step-by-step sustainable, but to be rushing back to this impossible deadline of 2024, wasting a lot of money to do so. Whereas on the flip side, Biden is a bit boring, right? And he doesn't excite anybody about space because he doesn't have much of a space agenda at all. I think that's fine. As I said, the less political motivation for human spaceflight, the better. Because once politics get into it, it becomes very expensive in the United States because these programs, in a very cynical way, they're not about exploring space. They're about providing jobs to various different states in the United States. And that's been a problem with the space shuttle and the International Space Station, how these things, parts of it were built in like all across America. And they were assembled here, built here. And it just added incredible cost to the situation. So if there's someone like Biden, if he has less interest in space, all the better. So I think that's a good thing. Now, the China situation is serious. It was Obama that in that era that signed the Chinese exclusion policy that barred the United States from working with China to a great degree. You had stated I was at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center. We're not even allowed to host Chinese scientists there anymore. It was a great schism because they were accused, and it, you know, it does seem to be very true that they stole a lot of information from contractors in order them to advance their missile technology. I don't know how to mend that. You know, they are a very ambitious country. I'm about human beings. I'm less about governments. The government of China is not as great as it's the people that make up that country. And so I'm hesitant to interact with China as well because of these constant stealing of information, the government. But Biden might be more willing to interact with them. And I think that has people nervous because he would want to reconnect to China.
The private views of former NASA employee and now author of the book Spacefarers, Christopher Wonjick. Now, the book is supported by 22 pages of references and it has a detailed index. It was published this year by Harvard University Press. It is available from the Book Depository, Dimmicks, Readings, Booktopia, and elsewhere. And I note that Booktopia has an ebook version, whilst Audible has an audiobook. Now, Christopher Wonjick's Spacefarers is not to be confused with Michael Neufeld's 2013 book of the same name. So this is Spacefarers, and it looks at how we can possibly move and live off planet if necessary, if we want to, if we decide to. Right now, we began the program with a song about a honeymoon on the moon. Well, here's another fanciful song, and it's about a honeymoon on Mars. It's by Hardy, and it is an entrant in the 2000 Roger DeLisle Song Contest from the Mars Society, which promotes the settlement of Mars.
I'd like to make myself a home somewhere up in the stars. I'd like to settle down on the sunny side of Mars. I'd like to feel that old red planet underneath my shoes. I'd like to walk along those Martian avenues. I'd like to snuggle up together through the Martian night when it's 60 degrees below, and wake up in the morning and not have to shovel the snow. Is there snow there? I'd like to look into your eyes and see a million stars, and hold you in my arms on the sunny side of Mars. Martian night when it's 60 degrees below, and wake up in the morning and not have to shovel the snow. Is there snow there? I'd like to look into your eyes and see a million stars, and hold you in my arms on the sunny side of Mars.
This is The Space Show, and we remind you once again of that sky spectacular. It's called the Grand Conjunction. Conjunction is when two planets appear to be in more or less the same place in the sky. So tonight and tomorrow, the crescent moon will be close to Jupiter and Saturn, and over the next few days, Jupiter and Saturn will appear to move closer and closer to each other. Then, on December the 21st, they will be just 0.1 of a degree apart. And that means that you may look out there and say, oh, where's Saturn gone? It's disappeared. Well, it's so close to Jupiter that you probably can't see them apart. Although if you use binoculars or a telescope, you can. But you don't need a telescope or binoculars to enjoy this spectacular event, just the good old naked eye. So where do you look? You look out to the west, and it's some degrees above the horizon, just after sunset, you know, when the twilight starts to end. So well worth a look. And reminder, the last time that Jupiter and Saturn were this close was in 1623. That's just after Galileo had used the telescope to observe some interesting phenomena in the skies. Well, this has been the Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie from the Space Association of Australia.